next case is 98-616, State of Ohio v. Tomako et al.
The statute of limitations is violated, not whether Mike Miller is a good prosecutor.
Well,
let's just stay with the law.
Point that I thank you for the question. There was surely, dilatory, and inefficient conduct in this particular case. I would address Judge Wessler's opinion in the Hensley case, which he basically indicated that the statute is designed in part to discourage, I'm quoting, inefficient or dilatory law enforcement, and we certainly have that here.
Counsel, the question a little bit about this. 1986, that the first inspector general and the inspector general, I wasn't trying to do that. But
well, Dean Meeks, after I think an 11-month investigation, determined that there was nothing here. The IG did likewise. However, some 2.5 years or more after the running of the 2 years, they went to the grand jury and got a new indictment for in this particular matter. The story of this case is that
the question that the state would get to the inspector general to make that decision
versus Mike Miller making that decision. I suspect he's sent there. Matter of fact, he sent him away twice.
Interpret B as you are arguing, what do we do with that? What does that mean?
Well, that was properly applied by Judge Resnick in, I believe, in the Hensley case. Yes, comes into play, but it doesn't trump all the rest of the statutes. If you apply F to every single case, B, C, and D are intermediate.
How do we decide when F applies and when it does not apply?
I believe that's
Hensley, if you look to Hensley, or
can you get the nail right on the head? That's the issue here. Our posture, of course, is that F certainly doesn't apply to the facts in this particular case. Now, for example, if comes into play. The prosecutor mentioned a great argument to the effect that, I guess, falsification and fraud do not equate with one another. I'm confused by that because I got my trusty Webster's New American Dictionary, and there's some on page 343. And I have to return this, by the way, to my bride tonight, so we must find one tomorrow.
Well, we have the unusual situation where the prosecutor is arguing for a very tight, restricted definition of fraud, and the defendant is arguing for a broad definition of fraud.
You know, that's it. To me, that's remarkable. That's remarkable because I think it's black letter law.
On that subject, let me ask you this. You were a trial judge for a long time, and I want to give you a hypothetical.
Okay.
I robbed a bank. And the statute of limitations on bank robbery, to bring a cause of action, let's say, is 6 years. 8 years later, they find out I did it. And they indict me and bring me to your court. Do you grant a motion to dismiss?
No,
why wouldn't you grant a motion to dismiss? It violates the statute of limitations.
That's what the saving statute is all about now. The difference between the two, if I may, is B deals with the issue of fraud and falsification. B is bold. F, that's the specific part of the section.
So F applies to everything but fraud.
Pardon?
F applies to everything but fraud and murder.
I think that's true. Well, murder, of course, in your
case. None at all.
And, I, by the way, I know for some
so if they had charged the appellant here with not a fraudulent reporting, let's say, is stealing fraudulent?
Yeah.
All right. So he gave the contribution, and then he stole it back. They didn't find out that he did it until after 2 years. Okay, so it has to be an offense based on fraud.
It has to be as B, as outlined in B, which is specific.
So there never really is a statute of limitations on any crime other than fraud, your contention, if the prosecutor or somebody doesn't know it. Doesn't start to run until there's knowledge.
We have a rather precise definition of the discovery of the purpose of the lifetime. If it meets that, definition, you can go forward.
How do you respond to the prosecutor's argument that if we adopt your interpretation that the state has less time to prosecute for fraud than it does other misdemeanors? Do we think that's
right? By the way, not my theory. It's a special case.
Well, but those are court appeals cases.
Yes, indeed.
We're not bound by them. I'm thinking.
I don't think this court has ever come directly, has ever dealt directly with this particular issue. Although, as President said, it deals with the scope of government, and it should be limited in character. I think we both know that. I do want to save plenty of time for the rebuttal, but I would like to say our briefing materials reflect the core of case law and the various sources of the plot of the notion that's impressed by the prosecutor. I have, from time to time, gone over my adversary's brief. They make much of my reliance on what they describe in various ways. Technicality to avoid the consequences of wrongdoing. I can only say that the law, unlike college, in this case does have some sort of overtone, should not concern itself with the good or evil in the status quo. The law requires that one's status not be set to unfair or legally improper DNF appropriately. It's our position, position of the two courts of appeals, but we cited in our briefing materials that caption apply in this particular case. Now, there was some major wrong in this particular matter, albeit minor character. But in my view, and I say this in all sincerity, it would be a much greater mission for this court to ignore the legislative history of the code section for solid reasons in the case law that we have presented in our briefing materials. If you have any further questions, I will refer to my colleague.
Thank you. Mr. Michael.
Thank you. Please, the court, my name is John Arnold. I also represent the appellant. Just that my remarks will be basically directed in an attempt to answer your question. It's been with a great deal of pride that I have appeared before this court to argue cases of great public or general interest with far-reaching constitutional dimensions, including issues of paramount importance to the fair and equal administration of justice. It's with no less pride that I appear here today. However, I also am embarrassed to be here. I'm embarrassed that today my client is my law firm. I and my fellow principals are embarrassed that one of our former principals caused himself and our law firm to be indicted and convicted. However, please do not misunderstand me. I will not argue for sympathy or compassion. I will argue for justice. It is essential to order, liberty, and justice that a rule of law not only be applied uniformly to all citizens, but that it also be applied to restrain improper governmental action. As Mr. Wright eloquently pointed out, as a result of the lower court's misinterpretation of 2901.13, precedent now exists, allowing the limitation period for misdemeanors to vary throughout the state. This is constitutionally improper and violates the legal maxim that the rule of law is preferable to the rule of the individual. But we believe that it's supported by citation and argument that the lower court's interpretation is incorrect. Even if one accepts the lower court's interpretation of 2901.13F, the indictments against Mr. Senator and my law firm should not have been returned. On February 1st, notwithstanding that the 2-year statute of limitations had expired, Mr. Senator and my law firm were indicted. The indictments followed a 24-month investigation of more than 25 individuals and entities who had allegedly failed to file correct, updated employer of legislative agent registration statements with the Joint Committee on Agency Review, JCAR. In each case, the filing of amended returns prompted the investigation. This, notwithstanding that the statute contemplated the filing of amended returns.
What if you add and accept that F applies here? Did they not discover this well before that period of time?
They discovered this on February 4th, 1994.
And so...
it wasn't until...
So why do you argue so vigorously against F?
Because F has been repeatedly misimplied against us. I believe that in either scenario, our indictment was improper. And it was specifically directed at Ken Senator because after investigating 25 companies, including Ohio State University and National Student Corporation, Kent State University...
But don't you accept that even applying F, you should still win?
Mm-hmm. I believe so, yes.
Because that's really our issue. Not even the selective prosecution and all of that. The question is, I think, before us, is the statute of limitations.
Yes, that is our issue one. But issue two...
Let me test you on that. If you want to continue responding, I have a question.
Justice, issue two is, I think, of also paramount importance when we deal with equal administration of justice.
But no, we need to... I'm sorry, your time's waning, and I'm wondering what your answer to Justice Douglas is. You said even if F applies, you win. And I'm wondering how I think that the justice is too. How do you win if F applies?
Because of the period and the length of time when they discovered the offense.
Well, if F applies from the date of discovery, which is February 4th, you say 94, then F, the time runs 2 years, runs till February of 94.
Well, first of all, our argument, Justice.
I mean, it runs from 96, 94 to 96.
That we think the reasoning, as Justice, as former Justice Wright pointed out, is that if F would apply, then B, there's no reason for B. I think our argument dealing with the model penal code is a very cogent, on-the-point argument. I don't know why the legislature included F, but what it has caused is a number of years.
Okay, but it's
F. It's understanding of the law.
If F applies.
I think that the application of F is inappropriate.
Right.
Okay, but I do want to try and get a question. Sometimes I follow your argument. You said that, I thought you said even if F applies, if we say F applies in this case, that you still win. Is it because you believe that they're still outside the 2 years that F gives? I don't, that's because I thought it was, the omission was found February 4th of 94, and I read the brief. Indictment came down on February 1st of 96. That's less than 2 years, I think.
I may have misspoke because I was overly anxious, and I apologize.
Okay.
Just to my part of the
sure.
argument.
Give me a clear.
It bothered me for a number of years.
I can understand.
Okay. I do not believe that. I think
okay.
it is misapplied.
Well, I understand that, but I thought you said that even if that's
misapplied. I misspoke, and I'm sorry, and I have attempted to correct that.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, in further answering you, Justice Bratton, the crime exhibit J4 was a letter that the prosecutor sent out 7 days after we were indicted, sending to the Inspector General the 19 other yet ongoing open investigations. The quote is, if from your review and investigation, the other amended returns, you feel, need further investigation, investigating, if you then believe so, send them to the Attorney General's office, and they can then refer them to this office for prosecution. I, for 2 years, had urged the Franklin County prosecutor that was the procedure to follow. I had urged them not only directly in connection with our incident, but other individuals we were involved in this investigation. But it was after the fact that it was referred to. There is a very interesting line in Mr. Ellis, the prosecutor's letter. In the last paragraph, he says, my impression from discussion with you is there may be a reporting violation concerning Mr. Kennedy and or his employer. I do not intend to pursue this without some investigation and referral from your office through the Attorney General. I submit that is acknowledgement after the fact that was the procedure that needed to be followed. Subsequently, in order to justify indicting Mr. Sumnator in our firm, the prosecutor then comes in with the thrust, we could have followed that statute, but we have independent authority to investigate, and if we decide criminal activity occurred, then we have the independent authority to prosecute. Now, when the Office of Inspector General responded to the prosecutor in 19 instances, she said the statute of limitations expired or there was no knowing violation. The prosecutor accepted that. The prosecutor accepted that the statute of limitations had expired for the 19 others, but did not for us. So in one case, the prosecutor, we believe, appropriately accepted the correct interpretation of the statute of limitations, but when it came to us, decided another way. What we're hearing is attempting to justify that exception. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor.
I too want to pursue my other question with regard to whether even if F applies. What was the date of the indictment?
February 1st, 1999.
And when the amended return, this firm and others were asked for to file amended returns, were they not? Amended reports.
What happened was, sometime around February 4th to February 7th, I think Senator Watt filed a financial disclosure form in Washington, which he indicated he received honorary from a responsible firm and from others. And this prompted a newspaper article, et cetera. And eventually, the executive director, Jay Carr, put him together and saw that there was an apparent violation because, as I recall, they reported zero.
And that was in early 1994, and then he contacted Senator and others and agreed that they should file amended, updated registration statements. And that happened by March 22nd, 94. He was in possession of that. Now, he knew, obviously, before that period of time that there was an alleged violation. Otherwise, he wouldn't have asked for an amended return. Is that correct?
I don't recall whether he specifically asked for an amended return, but in discussion between him and the Polanco firm, I think the Polanco firm eventually decided to file an amended return. I'm not sure whether that is his business or whether they decided he was going to file an amended return. But anyway, it's an undisputed factual finding in this case that discovery of the Corpus Selecti occurred at the earliest
You filed it when?
February 1st.
Somehow you have to explain the way.
And I am trying to explain the if the agreed, if someone, someone other than the agreed person discovers or something like that, that starts the chain of five removal. But it doesn't necessarily start the 1 year five or fraud.
Well, the election commission is saying, who is the agreed person to elect the election?
Everybody.
That's not a fraud, but I would say.
Can B be triggered? B, the start of section D says if the statute has expired. That's a prerequisite to the triggering of B, isn't it, counsel? B says if the statute, if the period has expired, and then it goes on. Right. And that's, I guess, the argument is, can it expire before there's discovery of the corpus delicti?
Well, I don't think it can, because when you look at it, I think that after the period of limitation provided in Division A of this section has expired, well, Division A incorporates the corpus delicti exception. It says, Division A says, except as otherwise provided in this section, the prosecution shall be barred. So, Division A is incorporating the corpus delicti provision for determining when that initial 2 year period for misdemeanor will expire. So I think the way everything would operate would be the 2 year clock does not start to run at all under the corpus delicti provision unless someone discovers the corpus delicti. Now, let's say that someone is other than the agreed person, then let's say 2 years elapsed and the period in paragraph A has expired. Then the person with the agreed person discovers the offense. Then that person has an extra year. It extends the statute of limitations that has already expired. And
of course, in implicit in it having been discovered, there has to be someone who has discovered it. I mean, you know, once it is expired, only in your rationale, only because it's been discovered by someone in keeping with that. Most crimes don't need a bunch of discoveries. We know that. This is an unusual scenario where something is not readily known on the day it's committed. But it has to have been discovered by someone. And so this is your argument is there's some peculiar benefit here for an individual, although the statute doesn't really say that. A grieved person includes a prosecutor, doesn't it, in B? I think it does. It doesn't. Legal representative, okay. It has to be triggered by somebody knowing it, though. Even B has to be triggered by someone having discovered it, according to F. I mean, B doesn't start to run, according to you, until the corpus delicti is discovered, because we know it has to have, A has to have expired.
Who's the agreed person in this case?
There's nobody. Well, in my contention, this is not a fraud offense, but as a victim, and therefore that there's no agreed person to discover.
Isn't your argument that B applies to the situation where somebody goes
no
to a house and says, I'll repair your roof, and I'm going to use A1 materials, and the person uses very faulty materials. Yeah. 2.5 years later, the homeowner finds that the roof leaks, collapses. The aggrieved person there, the homeowner, can file to go to the prosecutor and ask for a prosecution to be filed against her, a complaint to be filed against the person who fixed the roof. The aggrieved person there has a year after the 2 years has expired, 2 years from the date the roof was installed, has expired, but within 6 months after that time, the homeowner finds that, oh, my roof is, you know, they used the fraud. They defrauded me. They told me they were going to use, you know, certain materials, and they didn't. It's your contention that's the situation for the B kind of place, the individual, the person where you can identify an aggrieved person, person who's been aggrieved by fraud, and gives them obviously an extra year after the statute is given. That's your argument.
That's what my conception of an aggrieved person is.
That's not this case. This case is because this case F applies to all the other misdemeanors where corpus delicti has not been discovered for some period of time.
My notion of aggrieved person fits in with my notion of fraud. The court has said in the past that common law words that actually treat common law understandings and meanings are often counter law meanings are applied to such terms. In Mansley case, when this court was trying to figure out what the word corpus delicti meant in this statute, this court applied its previous kind of case law, which said corpus delicti is the act, criminal entity the act, and this court said we'll adhere to that definition. I think the same analysis applies here. Common law meaning applies to this common law term of what fraud is. And what common law fraud is, it's false statement, detriment, or lying, and to the law. Counsel, there's no element of that.
Because it starts with the time has to expire. So even D presupposes some F-type discovery before D starts to run, before the 1 year starts to run.
That's my assumption of how the statute operates. Otherwise, why is the purpose of having paragraph D? And it seems to me that there is provided an extra year of protection. But under the defense rationale, the person who's a victim of fraud receives plenty of rejection from the victim of amount of fraud done.
Who's the victim of fraud here?
There is no fraud. This is not a fraud defense.
Well, I know that's your great point, yeah. The whole reason, though, isn't the public a victim of the fraud here? Isn't the whole basis for the statute to say thou shalt not file false reports because these reports are for the benefit of the public? And therefore, that the victim of a false report would be the public.
Well, if this court says it's a fraud offense, then it would be effectively saying
it would be the person. Yeah, it's got to be all of us.
Right. Because there is no direct victim here. There's no one who lost that
business
because of false statements.
But the statute, the limitation section doesn't speak of victims particularly. It seems to protect a certain scenario.
Well,
but it's still for
crime.
Typically, fraud victims are looking for money damages, not criminal.
The aggrieved person aspect of the statute defines immediate, I think, is really a secondary issue as to what fraud means. And when you have a qualification statute that just says you're going falsehood in a required report, that's a crime. minimal statements with the intent to defraud, those are not elements of this offense, and therefore they are not fraud offenses to which paragraph B applies.
Would you address the authority of the
we sent a letter to the director of jailers, or to the chief counsel over there, saying if you want to get these cases, go ahead. That's within our prosecutorial discretion. It's also within our prosecutorial discretion to address the cases which we believe are particularly egregious violations of the statute. And we were addressing a particularly egregious problem in this case, which was the so-called handshaking of honoraria, where a legislator would show up at a social event and end up getting two, three, four honoraria checks from different entities. Well, the report will be filed in Franklin County in the legislative, in the JLA or JCAR. So this would be where the offense would occur. If there's some violation that occurs in another county, that prosecutor would have jurisdiction to this court. In Buckeye Electric, and there's typical cases recognized that when the General Assembly provides the administrative mechanism in an administrative agency or on some other type of agency, that does not repeal by implication of prosecutor's general power to prosecute criminal offenses within jurisdiction. Such administrative remedies would be concurrent with the power the prosecutor would have to prosecute offenses. Basically, what these well, it's discretionary with the Attorney General what he or she does with information from jailing. But bottom line, I think, is that when you have this type of mechanism where the General Assembly is basically asking various people in state government, if you find something wrong, tell the prosecutor about it. That doesn't necessarily mean the prosecutor can't go ahead and find out about it on his own. And so this court, you know, may require certain require lawyers to report ethical violations. That doesn't mean the court can't proceed on its own to investigate such violations. And so that's just a concurrent mechanism that can be used, but it does not have to be. It's not an absolute prerequisite. And therefore, based on the Buckeye Electric case, I think this court would effectively have to overrule Buckeye Electric and TIPCA in order to find them in favor on the jurisdictional issue.
What was the date of the filing of the return or the statement? That's a question. What was the date? I'm trying to get now to the 1 year in B. So when did this occur? When did their falsification, when did their crime, if there was one, occur? Do we? Why do you lose? Because the 2 years in A, two has expired?
Well,
or don't you have a total of three?
For you to say that B applies to exclusion of everything else would mean we would be able to rely on paragraph F. We are relying on paragraph F, and that's the way we
forget F. The offending statement was in October of 93. Is that right? October of 93. All right. October of 93 or even June. Let's say June of 93. Then you had, if in fact we file A, you had 2 years to bring it. But if it's based on fraud, you have a year after that. Yeah, I understand. I'm just talking about time now. So we've got October, let's say June of 93, 2 years to June of 95. And then if it's fraud, but you have one more year, June of 96.
Well, the way paragraph B reads, we would only have one more year from wherever that discovery would occur, so we would have...
So you had... So the 1 year would have, yeah, the 1 year would have had to have run in from maybe February of 94.
But the operation by operation paragraph B, we only get a year
with that one. But don't you read B as applying only where the 2 years has expired? B is pretty clear of that, isn't it? If the period of limitations by Division A, the 2 years of this section, has expired, prosecution shall be commenced for an offense to which an element there's been an argument that it can actually begin sometime within the 2 year period, but the 2 year period has to expire. This B only applies when the 2 years has expired, does it not?
That's my contention
because that's why really E and F stand alone, because B contains that phrase, when the period has expired, and F deals with those situations where the corporate selection has not been discovered.
I think that's one of the points that the district was making, that you have corporate selection provision operating at the start, and the fraud provision operating at the end, so there's no conflict between the two. I think given the fact that the Germans adopted these two provisions at the same time, it didn't make a difference.
The corpus selecti is the handing over of the check as the party. Is that?
No, the corpus selecti was, in this case, was filing the false return. Yes, the notice filing the false return issued in October of 93. That's when the act occurred, however, the Criminal Agency of the Act, which is the second one.
But there are two different reports. The transaction that's wrong is pending.
Well, we were not prosecuting them for illegal pancaking from Russia.
But the legislator in question had a duty to report as well, right?
Well, that was one of the reasons why this investigation took so long, was to ascertain whether they did have a duty to report. If it came from multiple $500 payments came from the same source, then they had to be reported. But at the time, the law allowed legislators to receive $500 on their earnings, and if they were from different sources, they didn't have to report them. But if you receive multiple $500 payments and they all came from the same source, then there would have been a duty to report, so then in fact you received a $1,500 on their earnings from the same source.
So when was the first reporting by the reference was Senator Wise's filing in Washington, D.C.?
He filed an amended disclosure return, I believe, on February 2nd of 1996. This process is when the plaintiff reported to the offices of the GNR,
of 96 or
96. The Senator Watts financial disclosure form is February 2nd, 96. It's when the plaintiff report comes to the offices of the JCAR circa February 4th or February 7th of the executive.
And that would then be when the corporate selecti was discovered.
Correct. And that's what the trial was found.
You say 96. You mean 94.
94.
Yeah, I think you've been saying 96. Right.
I'm
94.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It was 94 when he returned to file. 96 when February 96 when discovery.
No, that's when you indicted. Strictly against the state. Is that right?
Yes.
It seems to me if we got to go through all this to get somebody, we're given a liberal construction maybe rather than a strict construction.
Well, I think that's a problem. Their broad view of what fraud means is not going to help some defendant down the road. In another case, who's trying to contend, I can commit a fraud offense, therefore you can't rely on the one year extension provision.
Okay. My guess is that's all they're interested in.
Yes.
That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. Marco,
30 seconds.
Very quickly, so the timeline is correct. Justice Pfeiffer, we filed reports on June 30th, 1993, October 15th, 1993. It was through correspondence between Mr. Semenator and the executive director of JCOG, where Mr. Semenator says, after researching this, I still appear to be confused. The executive director on February 10th, 1993,
The executive director on February 10th, 1994, writes back to him and says, in spite of your confusion, why don't you file an amended report? He filed the amended report on March 11th, 1994. My point is, the offense occurs with the false filing. June 30th, 1993, October 15th, 1993. Once we filed the amended report, they needed no more evidence to convict us, to indict us, let alone to convict us.
But to discover.
They have discovered already.
Okay.
It was discovered at that point in time.
What
it
day?
Was within the 2 years, Judge.
What day?
What day?
March 11th.
February 4th.
March 11th.
Of 94.
Of 1994. And we
did. Was there anything prior to that for them to discover the corpus collecta?
According to when you read the statute, we filed. They have an obligation to investigate the filing. And the statute, as I indicated, contemplates filing amendments. We filed amendments. When you read all the other 19 letters that were the covering letters accompanying the amendment, you will see that throughout the state, everyone was confused on what to do. But that's why we don't think B or F initially applied, because they found it during the two-year period. Now, if they were at the end of the two-year period, then you get into what the Mitchell Court is dealing with. But they had more than enough time. They had a special prosecutor investigate. Then they had the full Franklin County prosecutor. We were repeatedly in court filing action to attempt to have the issue clarified. So early on, the issue was clarified to them. It was on the eve of what they believed was their last breath, that they bring the indictment against us to get rid of it. They send everything else to the Inspector General, where the statute of limitations was appropriately determined. No one else is indicted. And they had covered one other thing, Justice.
It takes 10 seconds.
And that is what was saying, that, you know, this is some selfish person. If I was selfish in this, I would have taken the advice of some of my wise friends, paid the fine, put it away, and forgot it forever. But this issue has been in one common pleas court after another for years. And in most instances, no one could afford to take it all the way up here. But when I took my oath in 1967, I said I would represent my client zealously. I wasn't going to do any less for my own firm, notwithstanding all the adverse publicity.
Thank you, Mr. Camargo. The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion in the Marshall Supreme Court.